Okay, recording now. Today is...
Today is the 17th.
July 17th, 2011.
Thank you. The roll caller. And so, we're going to go for refuge? I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of doing the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of hearing the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of hearing the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. Okay, so... I put it on the website calendar that I'd be doing a review today, so we will be doing a review of the two Sundays that Geshe Yeshe Thapke taught. And but before doing that, I wanted to sort of step back a little and talk a little about translation and culture and other things that we sort of have to bear in mind when we're studying the teachings that originate in Tibet, right? So that means that we're studying them and they're coming from the Tibetan language. So then I've sort of been struck by this a couple of times in working with Geshe Yeshe Thapke. There was a... I'm sort of coming at it from a different viewpoint. I hear the English, and then I try to translate it into Tibetan. And then I get some, you know, Geshe's response sometimes is he laughs. He just sort of bursts out laughing. Like there's this one word. I guess it was on Tuesday of this past week that the monks were doing this. There's this offering dance that monks do, and so then I was calling it shabro, which in Tibetan is, you know, I was just thinking, what's the word for dance? What's the word? And then it's dance, right? And then shabro means dance, but in Tibetan they have, you know, two different words for dance. There's the monk's dance, which is chum, and then there's the, you know, layperson's dance, which is shabro. So it's sort of just the idea that they were doing some kind of a, you know, minuet up there or something. I guess it would be the way we would think of it. It's, you know, it was a religious dance, you know, performed by monks. And so I get a burst of laughter from Geshe. And then it sort of has its problems too. When I don't think we've had this in this particular round of teachings that Geshe has been giving, but this karma that we have the karma that all of us get involved in, and then there's the karma that has been translated as pure karma. Okay, so then I'm thinking pure karma. I don't think I've ever seen that in the Tibetan. You know, pure karma. And so I'm like, what is pure karma? And then so I asked Geshe, what is pure karma? So of course I was translating the word pure into something that I, you know, knew. Dakpa, right, means pure. Well, Geshe was like very puzzled. Right, what is he talking about? Oh, I get, you know, you could see him sort of going over in his mind. Why? Where is this coming from? And he goes, Sagme, you know. And I was saying Dakpa, but it's actually Sagme. And this is just sort of like points out that the difficulty in going from one culture one language to the next and one culture to the next, because Sagme means uncontaminated, okay? I mean, if you wanted to say uncontaminated karma, Now, Jeffrey Hopkins would translate it that way, but these other translations come out and say pure. Well, why do you say uncontaminated? Why don't we just say pure, which people would relate to, you know, in our culture much more easily than saying uncontaminated, because uncontaminated immediately calls to mind, well, what's contaminated? Well, what is contaminated karma contaminated with? So you just say pure karma, and I suppose people would say, well, why is it impure? You know, why is the other one impure? Mm-hmm. But maybe not so much. But it's talking about when you get to the point that you're not doing actions by thinking, I am giving you this book, and, you know, I am doing this, I am doing that, you know. And you don't have to think about, you know, everything. You realize everything lacks this kind of a independent self or independent, yourself and the objects you're giving and the action that you're performing all lack an independent self. You know, independent self for actions is a curious term, right? But what it means is that there's no findable action there, you know, between the giver, the gift, and the giving. You know, there's no, you can't distinguish some kind of independent action of giving separate from the giver and the gift. So then, so at that point, then you're performing actions free of this I, you know, this sort of adherence. This ascent. We're ascending to this false appearance of an independent self. And so then, when you're no longer assenting to this false appearance, falsely appearing self, then and you do actions, you're doing pure actions, you know, pure karma. And that's something that happens on the level of the we talk about the five paths, right? There's the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, the path of seeing, the path of meditation, and then the path of no more learning. That means Buddhahood. Mm-hmm. And so the path of accumulation is kind of the entry for the Bodhisattva. But then the Bodhisattva, then on the path of seeing, has realized emptiness, has had a direct experience of emptiness, so that his or her mind is just perceiving emptiness. The emptiness that's the object perceived and the mind perceiving are like pure water, pure clear water poured into pure clear water. So it's sort of like undifferentiable, right? Mm-hmm. And so that you're having a direct experience of a lack or the non-existence of this falsely appearing self in both things, yourself and other and others and objects as well. So then at that point you're accumulating pure karma. And this is kind of a digression. Okay, one way it's a digression because we're talking about pure karma, and then you're going to get curious as to what pure karma is to go, as opposed to impure karma, which is why you know we're talking about, you know, the problems of translation and mm-hmm. how to convey something in the easiest way, you know, uncontaminated or pure. But
I was just trying to get the five paths again.
Oh, the five paths.
Accumulation.
Preparation. Yeah. Seeing. Seeing means that you actually see emptiness directly, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to say you're having a direct experience of emptiness instead of through the medium of a concept. On the path of preparation, you're sort of refining this concept of emptiness. But then, on the path of seeing, you have a sort of breakthrough experience of, you know, sort of where the mind and emptiness are undifferentiated. It's hard to imagine, you know, what's that, you know, because we're so, I don't know, I'm always curious about subject object bifurcated, I suppose, is really what we are, you know. But it's really you having this falsely existent, you know, falsely appearing. You know, the way the self appears is false, okay? And it, so you think, I am here, I exist here from my side. And then all those things are over there, and they exist from their side. And that's the way things appear, you know. We don't, and that's because of our ignorance or lack of awareness of emptiness, okay? But if we knew the way things really were, then we'd be able to see through that appearance, right? See through it.
So there was accumulation, preparation, seeing, and no more learning. What's the one I'm missing?
Oh, the path of meditation, and then
that comes after what? Seeing.
After seeing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the
mm-hmm.
that's the those are the. There's the 10 bodhisattva grounds, they're called, or the 10 bodhisattva levels, we call it. And so on the path of seeing, that's called the first bodhisattva level. And then the bodhisattva goes through these stages of refinement and reaches the 10th level. And then the level after that is Buddhahood, no more learning. So you can be a 10th level bodhisattva, and then you're just about to become a Buddha. But you're, at that point, you're just getting rid of, on each of these levels, you're getting rid of the refined, I mean, it's just, the, you're getting rid of the afflictions. You're actually getting rid of them completely. It's a long... it may seem a long way off. It might be just around the corner. You never know.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure mine's a long way off.
It all depends on our effort, how much we apply ourselves. So then, you're sort of like, when you're on that path of seeing, then you start to, you start to have uncontaminated karma. It means that you're no longer, it's no longer contaminated by I, or the afflictions, you know. It's just, it's no longer contaminated by this, people translate it as grasping at the I, or, you know, because this I that we're, is appearing to us, the self that appears to us, whether it's here or the people around us or other living beings, is a falsely appearing self. It's just the I as it appears, okay? There's the I as it appears, and there's which is in a false way, because it's presenting itself as an independent self. That's the way it appears. But then, and then there's, you know, there's the self that's a dependent arising, and that's, you know, and conventionally existent, and that's a whole different ballgame. But you don't actually, you're not actually able to get at that, because this false appearance is constantly happening. You don't have the a perception of the real, you know. We're constantly, you can think of, we're projecting in between us and the real self this falsely appearing self, right? You know, it's just some kind of, you know, our ignorance is throwing it up in between, you know. We're just, it's obscuring it to us. You know, the false appearance is obscuring the real self to us, right? The self that actually does exist. Means doesn't mean there's two different selves. It's just the way it exists, the way it appears to exist as independent is impossible. It could never exist that way. So then it can exist in a dependent way, you know, so there is a bifurcation in the. But we adhere to, we assent to this false appearance all the time. And that's where all our afflictions come out of. they come out of assenting to that falsely appearing self. So then, it's just the way the self exists, you know. We're only refuting the way that self exists, you know. You can think of it that way too, because it appears to be independent. You know, I'm here. You know, I'm me, and I'm on my. You know, I don't need anything else. You know, that's if you don't think that you actually appear that way, just try thinking of a situation where you got really angry, or you really wanted something, or you're really hungry and you wanted to, you know, you wanted to eat or whatever, you know. In all those situations, it becomes very clear what we're talking about, because it's just like me, you know.
What about me?
Yeah, right, about me, you know, that's it. And, you know, it's a very strong sense of me. But that strong sense also happens all the time, you know. But it's just not so strong, you know. We're not so aware of it. You can make yourself aware of it when you have a strong sense of pride or anger or like that, you know, or even a strong sense of I did something wrong, you know. All of those situations, you know, help you to see it more clearly. But it's very apparent all the time once you become aware of it. Mm-hmm. Then you go, oh, you know, that's happening to me all the time.
What is the situation when you said, or when you think I did something wrong?
No, you're thinking badly of yourself. You know.
Oh, I see.
You know, oh, I really blew that. You know,
then
I shouldn't have put $200,000 on that one investment. That wasn't a very good idea. And then you feel really badly about it.
I was thinking of Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh. Oh, woe is me.
Yeah, right. But anyway, it's something like that. So then that's gone, right, in this other uncontaminated action. You know, you don't have that anymore. So that's why everybody's trying to reach that path of seeing, you know, the understanding path of seeing. But I was just thinking that, you know, our culture gives us a certain perspective on these words, right? There's a relationship between culture and the words people are using, and people are trying to, you know, they're trying to throw a word out there that's going to work for everybody so that they can understand the idea really easily. And that's probably what's coming when they think of pure, you know, using the word pure. But the other one is just, we discussed the one previously about Buddhism is, you know, people say, is Buddhism a religion? What is it, a philosophy? And, you know, they want it to, in a certain category. Is it a religion, a category? You know, is it a psychology? You know, is it some kind of a mind science? I guess it's a word you can, you know, science of the mind, and about cognition and how the mind works, you know. So we're sort of in the same spot as the Tibetans were when they received the word dharma. You know, dharma is the Sanskrit for what the Buddhist religion was conveying, you know, was bringing up to Tibet. It's the dharma. The Buddhist teaching is the way we translate that. But also it gets translated as religion, chö. And then so we were discussing that chö really means, you know, controlling your mind, really. It means to discipline your mind. And self-control is another way of thinking about that. And But dharma means to hold back, from hold you back. It's what holds us back from being reborn into a bad situation in our next lifetime, practicing the dharma. But in our culture, and this is something that Thupten Jinpa was talking about. I don't know if that talk is available online. That would be very good to listen to. But he gave a talk, and then somebody told me about the talk. And so I thought, huh, yeah. He's interesting because he sort of translates for His Holiness, and then he thinks about these things and lives in the in Canada. So he, I'm resisting saying the West, you know. He lives in Canada, and is, you know, kind of comparing, and he's involved in academia where there's a department of religion, a department of philosophy, a department of science, right? I mean, everything's been sort of separated out. Whereas it wasn't that way. That wasn't necessarily necessary to do with Tibetan Buddhism, you know. And so everything sort of got lumped together. And so His Holiness is sort of talking about, well, Buddhism is a religion, there's a mind science, and then there's the philosophy, right? Okay. So you can get interested in all these things, or you can separate them out, you know. He sort of recommends somebody who's a, you know, a Christian, not to get involved with the religious part of, or no, sorry, the philosophy part. The philosophy part is sort of in, you know, it's, instead of having a God creator, you have karma as being the creator, the mind as being the creator. So it's like, you know, so then there's going to be some kind of a difficulty there, you know, because then there's, well, God couldn't be the creator, you know. There's a lot of that kind of discussion, and that would be unsettling for somebody who is like a committed Christian, right? And so, but they can get a lot out of just studying the religion and learning things that are more common, right? And in common, held in common, mm-hmm. You know. And also studying the mind science, you know, they can learn about the mind that way. But without any, you know, so His Holiness is pretty clear about that, you know, that you can't really draw like these, some kind of, well, emptiness is like something, you know, like some kind of thing being taught, or the cloud of unknowing or something like that in Christianity or something like that. And, you know, people try to draw these parallels, but His Holiness is sort of like, I don't know about that. You know, he doesn't think that that's a really legitimate way to go. But a lot of people do it anyway. But anyway, the idea is that he recommends people, you know, sort of, if you have, you know, already have a religion that you're, you know, strongly adhere to, then, you know, then certainly, he says, stay away from it. The emptiness teachings, the Buddhist philosophy. So then, but I think the idea of religion is in His Holiness, what is the idea? In His Holiness's perspective, what is this idea of religion? I think it's not this definition of chö, which we might think. It's more this commonality of everybody believing in a supreme deity, a supreme being of some sort, and then, you know, sort of be interacting with this supreme being. Yeah.
And just to go back to your question about pure and uncontaminated, wouldn't it matter, you know, what audience you were speaking to? You would have talked about, you know, knowing who your audience was in terms of your choosing of words. Of course, if you're writing a book, you don't have that freedom.
Well, you're still writing it for an audience. Yeah, no. Karen is saying, don't you get to choose terminology according to the audience? So then, that's what's wonderful about translating. You know, when you're translating for, or interpreting for a teacher, you can throw like two or three words out there because, you know, the audience, you figure, well, somebody's going to pick up one of those words. You know? I mean, maybe everybody will get one word that works for them. But in a book, you have to just sort of determine who your audience is, and you know, and then have a, you know, a terminology that works for that. So yeah, no, it is. There's many different ways, and you know, eventually, probably, I don't know how many years it's going to take. There's going to be some kind of a vocabulary that or terminology that works itself out that everybody is comfortable with. You know. You know, picking up adherence over time, right? Over centuries, I would guess. Over generations, anyway.
You don't get letters to the editor when you write a book of translate. You know, when you translate something.
Yeah. Well, I've often, yeah. No, Karen is saying, do you get letters to the editor when somebody objects to your terminology? Well, yeah, people do. You know, but they probably do it to your face. I've noticed. I didn't like that word. And well, sorry, you know. But anyway, I've often thought of writing some letters to the editor over words that I've read. What? Honey, you can't use that word. And I was going to write a letter to the editor, but whatever. You know, I've so far controlled myself.
Why? A lot of times we don't understand the words we're using ourselves because we're using them based on somebody else's context and we think we know what they mean.
Yeah.
And then when you look them up in the dictionary, it's like, oh, is that what that means? So
that's
it's like,
correct.
How can you hope to even do translation right when most people don't even understand their own words that they're using?
Yeah, right, that's true. In case you didn't hear that, did everybody hear what Kathy said? Could you hear? She was saying that, you know, just when we're speaking our own language, we often use words that we don't really know the definition of, you know, so that we're just sort of throwing a word out there and then going, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been using that word, you know, that's what it means, that? Oh, gee. But anyway. Yeah.
Josh, are there also areas of Buddhism where just the concept of having any language, anything conceptualized at all, becomes a problem in and of itself?
Oh, like something mysterious and in the well. See, in this particular, there is this whole feeling that, you know, something is inexpressible or something like that, right? And some experiences that are inexpressible. But in this system, you're always trying to express it. You know, you're in the tradition of. It comes down from India. I think it really is a, but it, you know, there's many interpretations of what the Buddha said. But this particular lineage and how we talk about the teachings is that you can get very close. You can express it you can conceptualize it and get very close to what you're trying to say. You know, what you're trying to indicate. I mean, and that's why the Buddha taught, right? I mean, the Buddha, many traditions, you know, sort of like discount what the Buddha taught, you know, and it's just sort of like that's for, you know, people who, you know, need to think about things, or that's for people who, you know, aren't yogis or, you know, aren't meditators, or, you know, there's a whole. There's different reactions. There's so many different kinds of people, right? I mean, but this tradition is very much into conceptualizing and refining your concepts. That you can refine your concepts and get a very close, you know, idea, and by thinking, you know, using your intelligence a lot, the more you can develop your intelligence and deepen your intelligence and get very close to, and then you have this, you know, through meditation, you know, constantly meditating and thinking in that way, using reason and experience and, you know, analogies and so forth, that you can then have a direct experience of that thing, you know, that, or, you know, in particular emptiness I'm thinking of, but even to have unbiased compassion, I mean, we can sort of imagine what that's like, right? But that must be, you know, when you actually have it, a very different kind of experience than what we're imagining, you know. But anyway, that's a good question, but I think that, you know, His Holiness does use this word mysterious, you know. I mean, I was noticing using it this past week, and just sort of, but when you get to the mysterious things he was saying, but mysterious, he's talking about really deities, you know, these people who have pure karma, you know, that it's hard for us to understand them. I mean, any of us could be one, you know, and we don't know, right? But it's hard for us to see, right? Because you can't see others' spiritual situation. It's those who are higher than you, you're not going to be able to understand that they're higher than you. Yeah. I mean, you can tell a little that they have certain qualities if you look at them very carefully, right? And it's said to be like, you can tell that there's a fish below the water because there's these ripples, right, on the top of the water. Being an old fisherman, now I'm a fish observer, not a fish catcher. So I'm always like observing the fish, you know, under the water like that. And that's what it's like. You can sort of understand, oh, this person is very compassionate, you know, or this, you know, just watching their demeanor, their mannerisms, you know, how they act under pressure, and stuff like that, you know. And if you watch them for a while. But in terms of then rating them, are they on, you know, have they had a direct experience of emptiness? Or, you know, and I don't know how that manifests, you know. You really can't, like, decide that. But if, you know, Buddhas can tell, oh, another Buddha, you know. But no, short of that, you know. And so somebody from a higher, more advanced level of spiritual maturity can tell somebody, tell about somebody of a lower spiritual maturity. What?
They do that by telling emptiness jokes, and if the other one gets it, they know.
Yeah, right. Emptiness jokes. Kathy is proposing emptiness jokes. If the person laughs, then, you know, oh, they must know something about it.
Unless they're just giving an impression that they understand.
What was that, sorry?
Well, unless somebody laughs just to be in the crowd, and you don't know whether they genuinely understand.
Right.
You can tell by the laugh.
Yeah, right. Karen is theorizing there could be somebody who's laughing at the emptiness jokes, but really doesn't understand the emptiness, right? Because they're just sort of laughing along, right? Presumably, if you were telling the jokes to ferret them out, you would know that they were falsely laughing. You know? But anyway. So we have this idea of a supreme deity, and we get to refuge, right? And this is where culture comes into play, because we're often talking about the word blessings, okay? And this causes some confusion, because I was trying to say earlier that we have a certain perspective about religion because of the culture we were brought up in, and then the religion meant such and such to us, right? And so then we're suddenly confronted with this new religion, right, Buddhism, and then you tend to just project your own understanding, right? I mean, everybody knows this, but I'm just going through the mechanics. And so so you have this supreme deity, and then you have this word blessing, and often people feel that blessing is somehow the supreme deity is sprinkling some kind of fairy dust, you know, like in Tinkerbell, you know, and the Peter Pan, you know, and suddenly you're doing, you have a totally new understanding or new way of looking at things, or a new, or you can fly, you know, like in Peter Pan. But anyway, so you really have to sort of be looking at the teachings just in, with a very, what do you say? You have to be trying to get behind these projections that you have, and to identify them in your experience. But the way to do it is just to look at how the teachings are being presented to you, and to think very carefully about what that would mean. It's very helpful to be able to ask somebody like Genye Shitake, because then you can clarify, you can get sort of break beyond your understanding. But I think the whole process is basically eliminating misconceptions constantly. You're eliminating misconceptions, and a lot of the misconceptions that we bring with us are from our cultural background, right? And so then this idea of blessings, we always use the word blessing, and some people say inspiration, and you know, and some people use, you know, I don't know, I think I've seen something else besides inspiration, but so when we're taking refuge, then we're taught that the Buddha is like the doctor. I mean, we can use analogies to understand. I think it's just as difficult. I mean, we're talking about trying to understand meaning too, right? I mean, it's not so different for somebody from a Buddhist culture, okay? They're still trying to understand meaning, right? And the Buddha still presented things in analogies. It's just that we can't assume that the Buddha is a certain way based on our own experience, because we're so related to these other cultural phenomena, and so then we have to look carefully at the paradigm of the doctor, for instance, if we're going to examine blessings. There's the, you know, the Buddha is like said to be like the doctor, and then the Dharma, the teachings, are the medicine, and the Sangha are like the nurses, right? And then the practice is like taking the medicine. Okay, you're taking it, that's that when you're practicing the teachings, then you're, it's like taking the medicine. And so the nurses then are the ones that sort of, so then the doctor would be prescribing the medicine, the Buddha would be prescribing the medicine, and then the nurses would be advising you how to, you know, based on their experience, you know, how the best way to take the medicine. And so there's this whole interaction. The blessings, right, the Buddha's blessings, receiving the Buddha's blessings means that you've taken the medicine and it's taken some effect, you know, there's some change going on in you, and what's going on is that your mind is turning from a harmful direction, you know, a non-virtuous direction, and then towards a virtuous direction. Your mind is changing, okay, turning in a constructive way, becoming constructive. And, it could be anything in terms of...
Things. see the same things clearer in a different.
Yeah, Candida is suggesting that you see the same things in a clearer way. Yeah, your intelligence improves too. I mean, I think that's intelligence. You're trying to understand, and then you're able to understand. What happens is that misconceptions fall aside, and it's sort of like constant. That's a constant process. It seems to be a limitless process of a misunderstanding falling to the side and a deeper understanding coming up, and so it seems clear, and then you've got to do it again. It just happens. It just constantly happens. It's like you're digging deeper and deeper and deeper. It's not like you can come up with something concrete like 1 + 1 = 2, right? I got that. You know, you're probably not going to get much deeper than 1 + 1 = 2, right? I don't know. Probably a mathematician would have something to say to me. No, it's not necessarily that 1 + 1 = 2. But in my world, anyway, 1 + 1 = 2. And I think I got it. Maybe my nephew, who's supposedly a very good mathematician, would have a different viewpoint. But I'm thinking that I got it. But no, it doesn't always work that way with our understanding of the inner life. You know, we're talking about developing an inner life. You know, where you're getting deeper understanding of it, that it's not, you know, that about you shouldn't be so involved with yourself. You know, you should be more involved with others. You know, I could actually do that, and doesn't this feel better? And then it suddenly comes back again, right? And you're constantly digging at that, or that you're, if you're in the Buddhist sense, I see how that understanding, how I'm ascending to the belief in an independent self or independent, phenomena that exist independently, and how destructive that is to me, and then you're saying, I'm just going to let go of that. You know, this constant cultivation of these two different things, and they're related, compassion and wisdom and compassion, nurture each other. And I guess is one way of saying that they're mutually, mutually beneficial. They help each other. And let me get along here, Karen, before we, and then hold that question. So then we get this idea of our mind maturing, okay? And this is another Tibetan or Buddhist concept when our inner life deepens, okay, we're maturing. In Tibetan way, the phrase used would be we're maturing, okay, with it, mimba, and then some people say we're ripening. For personally, I like maturing, but because I laugh when I think about ripening, because I feel like a piece of fruit, but
you're gonna rot.
Yeah, right. And if you get too ripe, you're gonna rot. But anyway, maturing. And then so it's sort of like that question. When do we sort of ask ourselves as adults, am I mature now? But now that I can drink, after 21. But and what is it that makes me mature? And so forth. And it's sort of like you could write books on that, right? Mm-hmm. That people would pick up and read, because it's a question. But in Buddhism, you're talking about maturing spiritually. You're opening yourselves up to opening. We're opening ourselves up to be more understand how things exist more deeply, and also to be more caring for others. And that's what maturity means. The more mature we are, the more spiritually mature we are, the more compassionate and wise we are. But then sort of understanding that we can do this limitlessly. I mean, that a Buddha has developed what's called limitless compassion, and also limitless wisdom. And I was catching myself as thinking of myself as being limited, you know, instead of limitless, you know? Which is like it just holds you back, you know. But there is no limit to this. It's just you have to patiently plow through one misconception after another, you know. And then, like for instance, in the Tibetan education, they have a way of plowing through these misconceptions by debating. You know, they'd get up and take a topic and debate it with each other, and then they say, "Oh, it's great! You're getting rid of all these misconceptions." You know. But you know, it's sort of like this ongoing process that we're talking about, and then so you can say when you have this experience of freeing yourself from and go from a certain limitation and becoming more open and more loving, more caring, and more intelligent, then that you're receiving the blessings of the Buddha. To go back to that idea of blessings, that's you receiving the blessings. Okay, but it's not like the Buddha somehow made that happen for you. That you had to put the teachings into practice and apply yourself, your intelligence, and mainly your intelligence, you know, because still with in your awareness. I mean, developing an awareness, right? You have to constantly be aware of what you're doing. You have to
analyzing
what's going on, you know, and why is it this way? You know, it's a very, you know, a questioning, a critique, a self-critique. But not to, I know that you can get carried away in that kind of a pursuit too, but it's just an awareness that's constantly watching how what am I doing, what am I saying, what am I thinking, and couldn't I be you know, thinking or speaking or acting in a better way, you know, and that would be more helpful and more constructive. And so then, well, how do I get myself to do that? You know, mine is constantly like, you know, after years of listening to music, right? It's kind of, nowadays, when music starts playing in my head, I go, well, couldn't I be doing something else besides listening to this music, you know? And so then I start, you know, reciting mani, or, you know, thinking about, you know, a teaching, you know, that I've been, you know, concentrating on, and so then I use these habitual things, right, as an indication that I should be doing something different, you know. But you got to catch yourself. But for me, it's kind of easy, because the minute I'm not doing something, a tune starts coming in, you know, or that I'm getting really nervous, or you know, like if you know I'm preparing to go down to Washington, you know, the tunes start to get louder, you know, or something. I say, well, that's not going to help me get through this situation and calm down, right? But, you know, I'm just saying sort of like what kind of a device you could use to help you to, you know, would it open yourself up more to deepen your inner life or whatever, however you want to put it. Yeah, that's sort of, I don't know, we have the classes with Genlai, but that's just to sort of step back with, that's what I've been trying to do with this kind of an introduction. I mean, you could say I'm reviewing, but I'm not really reviewing. So I could review from now on, I think it's just to keep these things in mind, I think helps when we're studying. That you have to have these things in mind and see, you know. I mean, it's really when you focus on what Geshe-la is saying, then you can use what he's saying. You know, try and use what he's saying to deepen that process that I'm talking about of receiving the blessings, quote unquote, you know, of the Buddhas, you know. It really depends upon our own effort.
Josh?
Yeah.
Could we ask a couple questions now about what you just spoke about?
Yeah, that's right. I was going to, before I go on to something else. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess the blessings thing is, I'm glad you brought it up, and it's I find it kind of a hard one, because when I look at His Holiness teaching, you know, with those big tankas behind him and the monks all around him on the stage, or think about kind of how the Tibetans practice Buddhism, it really does seem like there's an expectation that something's coming in from outside, and that there really does seem to be a kind of power in the ritual and the blessing that feels like more than me just being open to it or doing my work in order to receive it. So it's, I guess my question is, what is there sort of a, other than what you've already said, a way to sort of think about it, or say something to myself when it feels that way?
Yeah, no. There is definitely an impact, right, they're really like symbols to me. I mean, everything, I'm very careful about what symbols I have around me in my workspace or in my living space or in my sleeping space. they do have a definite effect on your mind, you know, and it's how, you know, it's kind of like inspiration, and they do help you to keep your, you know, keep your, you know, you are then, it's like a support, really, right? It's a conducive condition, right? You can think of it that way, maybe, for you to receive the blessings, right? And the blessings are this actual process of your mind changing. Okay, that means you receive the blessings, but there are all these conducive conditions that help that to happen, right? What were you going
to
say, Candy?
I just wanted to say, is that Amy?
No, Nancy. Yeah.
I feel the same way when I see the Buddha on the stage and all that. To me, I see it as a positive energy, very strong energy.
Yeah, no. No, that's. There's no question that it has a very profound effect upon you, and especially if you have the more faith and understanding you have, and the more open you are, right? I mean, you know,
people. Same as a blessing, it's just the word you use.
Yeah, that's just a word we use.
With, I think it's the energy and the whole.
Yeah, you could. Candida is saying you could change the vocabulary to like the positive energy of that kind of a scene, rather than using the word blessing. I think Jinji Lap were using this word blessing for it, and it's definitely this changing of from a destructive state of mind to a constructive state of mind. It's just that process of, and then that, that means that the Buddha's, another way of saying it is that the Buddha's enlightened activities have entered you, and it's sort of like, and it's sort of you're opening yourself up. It's the, where the mind changes. That's the, where the blessing is. The other part is, maybe we can think of it as all these conducive conditions to helping that to happen, right? I mean, of course, you know, the monks are very careful the way they dress, and they're very careful the way they behave, right? I mean, because all of these things have an effect upon somebody who has some belief, right? That, that it's a positive condition for you to make a change. It's positive energy. You can think of it as mm-hmm. it gives you some positive energy.
And a lot of it in a concentrated space.
Yeah, believe me, when you've been with His Holiness for 8 days, you sort of feel like, Keshela said, were you both happy? And we're going, yeah, we were happy. You know, it's just like, you know, because everything's so positive, right? Yeah.
Josh, the question that Nancy brings up is such, it's a fascinating conundrum, because it seems like the human existence operates in the middle between, if we could see ourselves as we really are, then we would have a direct experience of emptiness. And yet we live with subject object, and so it seems that you said earlier that the advanced spiritual maturity, advanced state of spiritual maturity, predisposes one to have some direct experiences of emptiness, and so it's almost as if these outside cues are there to keep us at one of the highest reaches of subject-object reasoning, so that the next step off of that, like that's the last rung on the ladder, and then it's a direct experience of emptiness. And so it's like I said, we can't, to reach our human possibilities, we give up me, myself, and I, because it's not about growing independently, it's about growing interdependently. And so I think that there are karmic cues, or you know, there's the karmic dependent arisings, and then there's the, I'm only speculating now, but it gets you to a point where you're actually existing in a subject-object reasoning that's the precursor to direct experience of emptiness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's sort of trying to keep you up on that rung. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
It's trying to heighten your awareness at that time, so that you can have a more profound experience at that time.
To
right?
Fly from there.
Yeah.
It's like a perch to fly. And
yeah.
You don't really need the perch.
Yeah. Right. It's just like setting you up on a good on a high perch is what Jim's saying. You know, that idea of having all those. Having the monks and the tankas and His Holiness and the way they dress and so forth, yeah, it's allowing you to have a kind of heightened awareness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they just sort of had some
heightened
coke
awareness.
Machines and a few new cars parked up there, you know, or something like that. It wouldn't be very spiritually inspiring.
That
know.
Would be Bob Barker.
Yeah, new furniture and whatever.
Josh, I think that both Nancy and Candida are talking about, and tell me if I'm wrong.
We're probably making, I'm going to have to, we're getting, what? Go ahead. I mean, because I'm going to have to rephrase your question, I'm trying to say.
Oh,
I didn't set up the speaker, unfortunately.
They're both talking about receptivity. And maybe these symbols that Nancy was referring to kind of bring memories of something that something or an anticipation that something positive is going to happen, that there's going to be something in this, what one is about to hear, that is going to be extremely helpful, and I want to learn it. It's going to make a difference in my life. And that feeling is a kind of receptivity, which a symbol or transitional object could bring that feeling to mind. But I think what you are talking about is an interchange that happens by applying the Dharma. And I almost call this blessings of the Dharma. The Dharma were taught by the Buddha, but it's because you put into practice compassion or understanding of impermanence that you've made an interchange. You know, I wonder if you wouldn't think of that as a preferable word, Dharma, rather than...
It's the blessings of the Buddha is the way it's expressed. Uh-huh. It's not the blessings of the Dharma. But because the Buddha is the one who's teaching, right? Okay.
But the teaching would mean nothing if you didn't apply it in yourself.
Well, when you apply it and take the medicine, then you're practicing the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's expressed. It's not, if you actually take the medicine, let's see, Karen is thinking that maybe you can say the blessings of the Dharma, but actually I think it's expressed as blessings of the Buddha, the compassion of the Buddha. It's also said you can do this by the compassion of the Buddha, it's some kind of the compassionate activity. You're receiving this enlightened activity of the Buddha, and that's how it's really talking about the Buddha's wisdom and compassion, right? I mean, it's talking about receiving. But Candida and Karen were also using this idea of, instead of saying that there's these conducive conditions, you can also think of it as being positive energy, and then Karen prefers the idea of receptivity. These are just different ways that you could express the same thing. You know, we're all come up with three new terms. Three new terms for this, right? But it just depends what works for you. That's which I was talking about in the beginning. Whether you call it conducive conditions or positive energy or receptivity, I think we're talking about the same thing. We're just trying to try out new words. And it depends on your background, I think. But... It's not said the blessings of the teaching. No, it's talking about the Buddha's blessing. And I'm trying to, and especially in the context where I'm talking about religion and the supreme deity and our relationship to this supreme deity, and then how that comes through in this idea of blessings. See, that was my point. It wasn't like the Dharma is the actual refuge, it's the actual thing. The Buddha is the one who shows the way to refuge. Okay, I mean, it's protection or whatever it means for you, you know. And then the Dharma is the actual refuge. That's the thing that actually protects you. And then the spiritual community are those who help. Or like assistants, they're helping you to apply the teachings, but it's important in this whole process also to keep in mind this idea, which is what the first verse of Aryadeva is showing here, that we're really talking about in verse 1 about how the Buddha is the one who showed the way. The way Bhakti used to say it is, I've shown you the way to liberation. Liberation depends on yourself. You know, you have to make your own effort. The way His Holiness was talking about it, you might have heard this if you listened to the July 15th webcast. Is, again, what the 15th was, I suppose that's one that's not up there, Fred, right? But anyway, His Holiness was saying that time, you are your own master. You know, this is Buddha was very, you know, everybody has to take what the Buddha said and apply it to themselves, and do it all on their own energy. You know, we can't sort of decide on our own, I'm going to reach enlightenment. okay? And then we can't reach enlightenment on our own power in that way, right? We need the three jewels, all right? But the three jewels work in this way, right? That the Buddha can show you the way to refuge, show you the way to liberation, then the teachings that can actually liberate you, right? Especially the teachings on emptiness, and then the spiritual community can help you to achieve that liberation by applying the teachings. And so it's like the doctor, the medicine, the nurses, and then taking the medicine. And so you have to think of those dynamics, but also that it really does depend upon your own efforts. And the way His Holiness was saying was also, I showed you the path. Whether you achieve the path or not is up to you. Unless you yourself implement it, I can't give it to you. You know, it's not something that I can, you know.
Which chapter?
Oh, this is just His Holiness was saying.
Oh.
You know, on the 15th. And so this, but in the chapter 12, this is what really is being expressed about the student. It has to be the qualities of the student, you know, is what that first verse is talking about. And it says refuting wrong views, and it's talking about, well, why, if this, you know, even though you explained selflessness very clearly and extensively, and the Tathagata fully understood and gave instructions on it, why do most people not follow this teaching? You know, if it's such a great teaching, why didn't everybody follow? And then Aryadeva outlines these three qualities of being unprejudiced, intelligent, and interested. And I think this is this is something that's sort of the most compelling about what we've been talking about, because it's really saying that you have to critique the teachings in an unbiased way. You know, you have to have an open, you have to approach the teachings free of, well, I'm a Buddhist and this is correct, you know. Or you have to be able to, you know, accept them only if you've analyzed them carefully. And so Geshe-la was pointing out the way to analyze them is through our own experience, through reason, and then through if they're more obscure. I mean, it's talking about whether teachings are obvious, you know. There's different levels of top objects, that, you know, things that we're understanding. And so some things are obvious to us, some things are obscure, and some things are more obscure. And so we have to be applying our own direct experience to say, well, this is obviously true, you know. That's something that's obviously true is that, you know, I mean, we don't need to, we can apply reason, but, you know, that helping others is more, and being concerned for others is much more beneficial than being concerned just for ourselves. I mean, that's something that sort of becomes clear. Somebody is using their life to help others, right? But you can apply some reason to that. I mean, because we're only one person, and others are limitless. You know, sort of like, oh, you know, if you actually thought about it, you know, how could you just be helping this one, you know, this one person? We're all those people. You know, that all these beings need help. And so that's reasonable, right? It seems reasonable. But it's not too obscure, okay? But when we're trying to study things like impermanence and emptiness, and we can understand them more based on reason. There's some things that are just more obscure to us, which are very obscure to us, like the workings of karma, for instance, where you have to rely more on an authority, what the Buddha said. But anyway, what the Buddha said, but you have to then subject what the Buddha said to consistency. Is the Buddha then, you know, being very, you know, in the way he says things about karma, is he consistent throughout, you know, his teachings in about it, you know, and there are some things about karma that are not very obscure, but they're other things about karma that are very obscure.
Sure.
Oh, wait, let's just, you can, so I just wanted to go, you know, when we talk about that verse 1, right, and Aryadeva is saying that we should be unprejudiced without attachment to one's own position or aversion to others' position. It's just that's probably the most important thing that Geshe-la has been conveying in these first two classes, because he's been repeating it over and over again, is that having an unbiased perspective when you analyze the teaching, so that you have to not have attachment to your own position and hostility to others' positions. It's just you have to because you then you won't be able to distinguish, you know, you won't be, if you just think that's somebody else's, you know, teaching, it's not for me because I'm a Buddhist or something like that. You're not going to improve your intelligence that way. You're not going to get deeper into what the Buddha is teaching, and so it's basically keeping an open mind. That's another way of looking at it. We sort of translate it as nonpartisan, be nonpartisan or unbiased. And you critique something unbiased, and it's being able to step back and look at all the pros and the cons and make your own decision. Okay, so this is when it's talking about doing it on your own. Okay, we can't just sort of do it on our own in the sense of knowing the way to, and sort of I naturally know how to become enlightened. No, you need somebody who's already become enlightened to show you the way to be enlightened. But you have to do it on your own, and you have to take what they say and then apply it with you know, with an unbiased critique of all the different perspectives on it. So and there's this one praise of Aryadeva, is that he knew all the non-Buddhist teachings, and he knew all the Buddhist teachings, and he subjected them all to his own critique. You know, all the great masters of this tradition that began in India from the Buddha's time, but it's a certain tradition of Buddhism. They all, you know, Nagarjuna and Aryadeva, all, that's the way they approached the Buddha's teachings in this way of critiquing. You know, it's not just because the Buddha said, I'm the enlightened one, right? So you have to follow what I say. No, he said, I'm, you know, don't follow what I say because I say I'm the enlightened one. You know, don't do it out of respect for me. You have to analyze what I say with reason, using your own experience, and come up with your own conclusions, you know. And in that way, then you can, you know, that's the way I'm showing you to attain liberation. You can only do it by developing your own intelligence, basically, is what he's saying. You have this great intelligence. Use it, because it's the only thing, you know, as a human being that that makes us really special. I mean, it's not the only thing, but I mean, it is one of the things that makes us very special, is that we're able to use our intelligence to improve ourselves, you know, to improve ourselves. And so to lose, you know, to not develop that intelligence is a shame. It's a real waste. And it might be hard to do, but the point of the matter is that Geshe La is showing you how to do that, you know. And so then you have to then come back from the teachings and then, well, what did he say, and how is that going to help me to go deeper, to deepen my understanding, and then use that, you know, use those things in your daily practice. Like, for instance, he's always starting out with a precious human life. Well, if you recite those verses every morning and remind yourself that I have this precious human life and I have to make use of it, and just sort of like when you get up in the morning and you think, there's one Chandrakirti verse that I think it's here on page 122 in the Lamrim Chemo, yeah, in the Great Treatise. That it just at the bottom here, this is Geshe La uses this all the time, and the people in Tibet did. It's by Chandrakirti. Now I have independence and favorable conditions. If I do not take full advantage of this time, I will plunge into the abyss and fall under the control of others. Who will lift me out? It's like, who's going to help you then? You can help yourself now. And you've got this great opportunity. And so then Chenya said, that's what I recite every time before I meditate. You know, every time I, you know, just, if I'm going to, you know, I've got to use this now that I have it. Now, before I fall into the control of others. Like, even if when you're reborn as a human, you know, as a little baby, you know, these kids are, you know, we're just staying with teenagers. They're all under their parents constantly, right? Until you become, whatever, 21, then you're out of the nest or whatever. But it's still,
41 or
51. Yeah, or 51 or whatever, right? But you know, but it's talking more about being reborn into, like, as an animal or something. Then you're really under the control of something else. Somebody's always wanting to eat you, and you're always wanting to eat somebody else. it's a terrible life to be in. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that you know, you have to take what Geshe La says. He wants you to critique it. He wants you to, you know, examine what he's saying. And he wants you to also use it, though, to think a lot about it and improve your intelligence. And so, just like His Holiness was saying, you know, I'm trying to teach you what's essential, you know. He teaches in this way of getting to what the essential part is, and not sort of just to show off what, interesting things to know or something like that. So I thought I'd just mention that at the end. Do we have time for maybe one more question? If anybody had another question.
Josh?
Yeah.
Talking a little further about what Nancy was talking about, because as you know, I've communicated to you that I've had a lot of problems with the concept of blessings.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of that also has to do with my earlier Judeo-Christian upbringing and going to a temple where, you know, everything came from God, and you get raised with a certain perspective that, you know, it comes from, like, someone else, and it comes from the outside, and it takes a while with Buddhism that has basic freedom to let you make up your own mind. Where I think if you were a Christian years back and you spoke out, they'd burn you. You know, I mean, you know, not now, but
yeah, right.
Back in Europe, you would get killed just for having like an open mind. I know even a great thinker like Meister Eckhart was very close to being, you know, getting into a lot of serious trouble with the church for questioning things like that. So I think a lot of the stigma comes from that earlier Judeo-Christian concept of everything coming from an almighty and powerful God, and that we don't have any self-will almost. We all have to accept what's coming from the outside. And Buddhism is just 180 degrees, radically opposite from that. It gives you everything back, but it takes a while to get confidence from that earlier perspective.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm talking about in terms of just the cultural trappings. You have to work your way through those, you know. You really do. And it takes some time and some thought and some effort, right? But I think that, that if you can look at the teachings and what they're saying, you know, in a clear, unbiased way, right, is what Geshe-la is saying, then you can develop this, intelligence that then can see, oh, I see why I'm having trouble with this, you know, or what, you know, what's blocking me. You can identify things, right? But it does take time. I mean, it takes long, different time for different people. Some people get it quickly, right?
Buddhism's the only religion, if you want to call it a religion, that's truly interested in other people. Judeo-Christianity was, you're taught to believe in an external force that's controlling you because that was in the best interests of the Catholic Church to keep control over you.
Often,
you know, keep the information away from the people. Only the monks knew how to read. You know, they wanted to keep you in line. So
yeah, it's changed a little.
I agree.
Yeah.
Friends, you know, the whole culture of Judeo-Christian is to keep control. You know, Buddhism's the only one that's trying to make everybody better. For your sake.
I think all religions are trying to improve everybody, but there's some extreme behavior on a lot of part of all different religions. The fundamentalism is what you're talking about. They're very much attached to their own ideas, right? And that's what we're talking about here, is that you can't be attached to your own ideas. Buddhism has some rabid fundamentalists too, and so
I'm going to help you.
So you got to watch out. But it's just a human extreme. You know, it's hard to have this kind of unbiased critique. You know. It's hard to develop, and that's why, that's why Ari Davis saying that, oh, some people, you know, have trouble with the teachings on emptiness because of this. You know, they don't have this unbiased ability to, critique things in an unbiased way. You have to. That's why, you know, you can't be angry at Christianity, and you can't be. You know.
No, I was just trying to be loud enough for them to hear.
Yeah, I know. And you can't be, and you can't be attached to Buddhism. You know, it's an interesting perspective. And I can't say that that's the way I've been. You know, and certainly I was like, what do you say, an avid Buddhist. You know. I'm an avid birder, you know. I'm an avid bird. Everybody always Joshua, you know, he's just, you know, a little over the top or whatever. You know, my friends, you know, from when I was a kid. But anyway, still, you know, even if you're avid, doesn't mean that you can't, you know, have a balanced perspective. You know, you don't have to be a fundamentalist, right? Which is, you know, where you do have a strong sense of attachment, right, for your religion. I think then in our and our difficult experiences with other religions, then we probably run into some kind of fundamentalism, I would say. No, because there's obviously people like Meister Eckhart, and there's a very nice man who came actually to the Kala Chakra teachings. The Archbishop of Washington showed up. That was a very emotional moment because His Holiness was just like so pleased. It was just like he had him up on the stage and it was just like in front of everybody. And obviously this man had a very warm feeling for His Holiness, and it was mutual, you know. But boy, he should have seen His Holiness. It just seemed like so happy, you know, because he wants religious harmony, and to have somebody just show up was, you know, he had a wonderful relationship with the former Pope too in that way. And so then I think that, you know, that's really the ideal, is to be able to, you know, be very open and embracing of other ideas, but you know, not to the point of having to, you know, you just critique it. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean philosophically, like this only says, well, there's going to be differences, and you got to be aware of differences, but also you can be aware of the similarities, you know, mm-hmm. and keep a balanced view. Karen, maybe just one question. We should stop. Yeah.
Yeah, this would be brief, but when you were speaking of ripening and when your inner life deepens and your mind matures, to me, that aspect of Buddhism is what we would call in the West psychology. And it's interesting.
Integration or something in psychology?
Well, no, just maturity. It's interesting. I had an experience working with a student on writing, and after we worked so that his work flowed more smoothly and expressed what he wanted, I asked him to look back at his first draft and compare it to his second, and he said, this is more mature. And then he took it back and he said, no, I can't be saying that, but when we get in touch with our inner selves and our compassionate selves, our clear selves, that's maturing, and that's the goal of psychology, as far as I see it.
Mm. Now Karen is commenting that she sees this idea of ripening and maturity and, you know, deepening our inner life as also the purpose of psychology, where people can be able to deepen their, what do you say? You're saying to touch their inner self is what you're saying.
Well, maybe that's
another way of putting it. Yeah. What's
care
that?
About others.
Whoops. Skype they just all disappeared all at once.
They pulled the plug on the
Yeah,
lesson.
They just pulled the plug on.
How rude.
Boy, that was sudden. Uh-oh.
They're all coming back.
They're all coming back, presumably. What do I do with this? I think I have to ignore it, right? I think I got you all back. Okay. Hello again. Maybe not Fred. Oh, Nancy's there. Sorry, boy, it inexplicably quit there. You guys all went boom right at the same time there. I don't know, Fred doesn't seem to be back. Are you back, Fred?
I don't think Fred's back.
Yeah, there is a big echo.
This is Richard. I'm here.
Okay.
Rick's here.
Okay, you're back, Fred. I don't know. Amy, are you there?
I'm here. My camera's not working. I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're back in time to dedicate. We'll dedicate together. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri and likewise Samantabhadra as well, with whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times. I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you, Josh.
Okay, thank you all too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Josh.
Okay.
Nice.
You're welcome.
Give our love to Diana, please.
What's that? Oh yeah.
Give our love to Diana.
Yeah, well, I will. Yeah, she has a cold, so she's resting because she has that surgery coming up on Wednesday. Everybody, I think she told people mostly, but she's going to have a lumpectomy on Wednesday. So we appreciate everybody's prayers. I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Just barely, right? But even.
Yeah, it is.
I'm glad to hear that you're not a born again Buddhist.
Can I stop this?
Okay.